National Inspection and Repairs against George S. May International is our next case for argument.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Stegman.
Michael Stegman on behalf of Appellant NIR. This case involves an appeal from a summary judgment ruling against NIR on all counts. Our complaint involved the rendering of management services by defendant George S. May Company.
Before we get into the merits, I've got a question about appellate jurisdiction. Some of the papers that I saw in this case suggested that May filed a counterclaim. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What happened to the counterclaim?
It was dismissed. It was dismissed, Your Honor.
With or without prejudice?
I believe it
was. One reason why I'm asking this is because you failed to comply with Circuit Rule 30. Circuit Rule 30 requires every brief to contain a copy of the judgment. The judgment would tell us what exactly has become of the counterclaim. Now, I went and got some of these papers, and it looks like the counterclaim was dismissed without prejudice. Well, it's a pretty fundamental rule of appellate jurisdiction that until the whole case is over with prejudice, the judgment is not final. So what are we doing here?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure we have any control over whether the defendant can dismiss a counterclaim without prejudice or with prejudice.
Well,
we're the plaintiff appellant.
One, you can ask the district court to order it dismissed with prejudice. Or two, you can just wait until it's finally resolved. I mean, that's the normal rule. We have this problem all the time when the plaintiff's claim is dismissed without prejudice. Back about 15 years ago, we had a series of cases where district judges thought they could make judgments final and allow the appeal on one side of the case by dismissing a claim without prejudice with the plan to reinstate it once the appeal was over. And we held in a case called Horwitz against Alloy Automotive Company back in 1992 that maneuver was not successful and there was no appellate jurisdiction. This looks to me, maybe I'm incorrect, since the parties haven't addressed this in their briefs, but this looks to me like a replay of what happened in Horwitz against Alloy Automotive. And given our holding there, it doesn't look to be appellate jurisdiction. Now, maybe this is wrong.
Well, Your Honor,
May has actually dismissed its claim with prejudice. But until the parties address this with detail, your jurisdictional statement ignores the counterclaim. May's jurisdictional statement ignores the counterclaim.
Well, Your Honor, I will say that the court dismissed other parties and other claims entirely before we reached this point. It is the aim of both parties, I believe, that if this appeal is unsuccessful, that there will be no further actions in the district court. That was certainly the aim of everybody here.
You're referring to the dismissal of the claims against William Doan?
I'm referring to that as well, Your Honor.
But wasn't there a stipulation associated with that was
yes.
part of the dismissal order, which
yes.
resolves the problem that the chief judge has raised?
There was.
As to that dismissal,
if we have neglected to have a similar carve-out for the George S. May Company and their dismissal of counterclaims, we might have to go to the lower court.
Well, you may need to get this wrapped up, but actually there's one further problem, which is I wonder whether your notice of appeal is timely. If I understand that what's happened here correctly, you essentially threw in your hand acknowledging defeat and filed a Rule 42 dismissal. Now, we've held in cases like Fairley that's appealable, but it looks like the way Rule 42 works is that the dismissal is effective the instant it is filed and not when it is entered on the docket. But it looks to me from a simple count that this appeal is timely only from the day that the Rule 42 dismissal was entered on the docket, and not if time is measured from the time it is filed. Have you given any thought to that problem?
No, Your Honor.
Why in the world would you wait 30 days from the date a voluntary dismissal is entered on the docket to file a notice of appeal? Just hoping to create an unnecessary jurisdictional problem? If you're going to use this proceeding, you file two documents with the district court at the same time, a Rule 42 dismissal accompanied by a notice of appeal. But filing a Rule 42 dismissal and then waiting 31 days, which is what you did, to file a notice of appeal leads to questions like this, and one might think, orders dismissing appeals.
Well, Your Honor, I will have to review that. I believe everything was entered on the same day, 30 days from the court's order that
yes, that's your problem. A Rule 42 dismissal is effective when filed. It does not depend on a court order. Nothing else has to happen. That's what the rule says, anyway.
Your Honor, I actually do not know offhand when the order was filed, when the court ruled on it. We'll be happy if you want a supplemental memoranda to address these issues. I would be happy to do so.
Suspect I'll be making that order in this case as in the first case. Anyway, why don't you proceed with what's left of your time?
Your Honor, on the merits, this case involved the rendering of management services by the George S. May Company pursuant to a management service contract to NAR. One of the management services was to help NAR choose a new controller. And another management services that they agreed to provide was to help establish fraud controls for NAR. Unfortunately, the new controller chosen by NAR during the time the George S. May Company was helping out NAR was Mr. Doan. Mr. Doan was a convicted thief, a felon, who had been fired from his previous job after stealing from clients. Mr. Doan then began to steal money from NAR almost immediately after he became their controller. For our argument, we will show that George S. May Company committed six acts of negligence during its management services contract involved in rendering the management services, and these acts of negligence should allow NAR to recover its lost profits pursuant to its breach of contract and its breach of fiduciary duty claim.
I didn't realize there was a negligence claim in this case, or at least on appeal. I thought it was a breach of contract claim and a fraud claim and a fiduciary duty claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. Under Kansas law, for a company that's contracted to provide management services, there's a requirement that such services are required, are given in an appropriate, careful, workmanlike manner.
That's an implied warranty claim, which is a contract claim, not a negligence claim.
You're correct, Your Honor. If it's a...
You didn't plead or produce evidence on a negligence claim.
No, we presented it as a breach of contract for failure to appropriately implement the management services.
So why are you arguing to us that your opponent committed six acts of negligence?
And I would rephrase it as six acts of improper management services that were not careful and workmanlike.
In other words, breached the contract.
Yes, he breached the contract through these improperly rendered management services, which were not given with the care required for providing such management services.
Did they render management services? How did they do that?
They did, Your Honor. They agreed to provide management services through projects, which was another document signed pursuant to the management service agreement between the parties. And one of their management services was to assist NAR to interview and help choose an appropriate controller. And, you know, helping another company hire a high-level employee is a classic management duty. And they had their employee Doan present in NIR's office for a month to perform management duties such as helping them hire new high-level employees, establishing fraud controls, and other various projects we have discussed.
They were actually doing the decision-making.
They were assisting NAR in the decision-making.
Advising, would that be a better term?
I'm sorry?
Advising on how those decisions should be made?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
Didn't they have a provision that you were not to hire any of their employees?
Yes, they did, Your Honor. And while the court found this was an intervening event, which canceled any prior tortious behavior from George S. May, that was incorrect. And the court, neither the court nor George S. May has analyzed the law to discover when an intervening event can cut off previous tortious behavior. And in fact, the only way that can occur is if this intervening event is extraordinary and unforeseeable, and if the party's own negligence didn't contribute to this intervening event.
This isn't an intervening cause kind of an issue. It's a contract provision that prohibits your client from hiring any of your opponent's employees. And it seems to me that forecloses any claim based on your client hiring any of your opponent's employees.
Well, that's not the basis of our claim. They're saying that's an intervening event, even though our client thought he was complying with the contract when Mr. Doan gives him this fraudulent document on George S. May letterhead saying that there's a waiver here of this contract provision, and George S. May says you can hire me. And the question here is, who should be responsible for the fraud of George S. May's employee when they've hired this ex-felon or this felon who's still on probation, who was fired from his previous job? And also, when NAR tells George S. May that hiring the controller is the highest priority project, and George S. May fails to follow up as to who they've hired as their new controller. It's like a surgeon who goes on a vacation 1 minute after the operation. That's negligence. That is negligence not to find out who they hired. It's negligence not to supervise Doan as to what he's doing for this hiring.
He didn't make a negligence claim.
I'm only discussing that because that's how Kansas law determines whether this intervening event.
No, that's a serious misreading of Kansas law. The case that you've cited is an implied warranty case, which is a contract claim, not a negligence claim.
I understand, Your Honor. If
you've also got another fundamental problem here, which is that all of the damages that you claim are not causally related to anything that was done in connection with the consulting contract. They're causally related to the embezzlement, apparently, that was engaged in by Mr. Doan after the contract was completed and he left the employ of George S. May and went to work for your company.
Well, Your Honor, if the George S. May company had appropriately rendered management services, appropriately advised NAR on how to choose and interview a proper controller, then those damages wouldn't have occurred. NAR would have hired a controller who wasn't a felon, who hadn't stolen from his previous clients, and who wasn't currently violating a probation. It's, you know, as in Zenda, that management contract was also over by the time, in 1988, by the time Zenda plaintiff was able to recover the lost profits in 1999. Acts of mismanagement cause lost profits later. There's no requirement that the act of mismanagement causes lost profit during the next day, and that's unlikely to occur. We should be able to recover our lost profits for any acts of mismanagement which occurred while George S. May was rendering its management services contract. And, in fact, most of the damages in the Zenda case occurred well after the management services company had been fired. And, you know, the lost profits, the only requirement under Kansas law is it reasonably foreseeable what occurred here.
But and I still don't understand. Were your people still making the decisions?
The NIR president did have the final authority to make the decision.
Well, then they are, as I said, providing consulting. They're advising you but not making the decisions, right?
And they improperly advised us. In fact, Mr. Doan's advice that he was the best controller candidate, even though he knew himself that he was a convicted thief, a felon, who had been fired from his last job for stealing from clients, that goes beyond gross negligence. That was fraud. I mean, the George S. May Company, through their agent, Doan, is providing fraudulent advice to NAR on their decision to hire a new controller. And they should be, they have some responsibility for that. And it's up to a jury to determine what the share of responsibility here is. You know, just because a manager has someone above him who may make a final decision doesn't necessarily mean that the manager has no responsibilities whatsoever. Now, to conclude, Your Honors.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Lancelotti.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, the District Court in this case did not err in granting summary judgment in favor of George S. May on all of NIR's claims.
Lottie, before we get to the merits, there are problems of jurisdiction, as you've heard. I would like you to address them.
Your Honor, with respect to the dismissal of the counterclaim, I am not, as I stand here right now, certain if it was dismissed with prejudice or without prejudice, but I know the claims were dismissed. I'm just not sure if it was with or without, and I can address that.
You know whether it was with or without prejudice. I presume that you're not planning to reinstate it.
We were not planning
well,
to reinstate it.
Well, then why in the world wouldn't it be dismissed with prejudice? You can, of course, solve this problem by making sure that it is dismissed with prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then we have our second question, whether this appeal is timely. I think the technical question is whether this dismissal was properly understood as one under Rule 41A1, which provides the dismissal occurs, and to quote the rule, without a court order, close quote, or under subsection A2, which sets out the subcategory of cases where a court order is required. Do you have any view on whether this is an A1 or an A2 dismissal?
In this particular situation, Your Honor, I believe it was an A2 dismissal because I know the court was involved in ordering the dismissal and that it was required, Judge Manning required that Mr. Doan and NAR, prepare that dismissal.
Whoa. That's not the question I have. The sub A1 sets out a category of cases that are dismissed without the court order, and one of them is dismissal by agreement. Right? It's not clear that a judge who says, I'm going to disregard the rule and enter a court order, even when the rule says there shouldn't be a court order, it's not clear that that is effective or that it changes the time for appeal. I think we need to know whether this is properly in A1 or properly in A2. And as you can see, neither of you has thought about this question. So I'm, as in case number one, I'm going to give both parties 14 days to file jurisdictional memos. And the memos need to cover both the Horowitz problem, whether the counterclaim was dismissed without prejudice, what the effect of Horowitz, and I'm just giving Horowitz as an illustration. There are many other similar cases. What the effect is if it is without prejudice, and this is a problem that can be solved by making the dismissal with prejudice, and then a timeliness question that has to do with whether this is properly understood as an A1 or an A2 dismissal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to NIR's breach of contract claim, Your Honor, the district court correctly held that NIR failed to provide any evidence that May breached any contractual obligation owed to NIR. With respect to plaintiff's fraudulent and negligent misrepresentation claims, the district court correctly held that May made no representations of fact to NIR. There was no such evidence in the record. And that even if it had made such a representation, the record was still void of any evidence that NAR justifiably relied on such statements to its detriment. And finally, with respect to plaintiff's fiduciary duty and constructive fraud claims, the district court correctly held that neither a fiduciary nor a confidential relationship existed between May and NAR, warranting summary judgment in favor of May on those counts. I may back up to that first issue with regard to breach of contract. Again, the district court found that that the record contained no evidence that May failed to perform its contractual duties owed to NIR under the agreement. Now, the agreement itself contains a contractual obligation, which is essentially for George S. May to design and provide recommendations, which they do through what they call programs, by which NIR could meet its objectives. And the objectives of NIR are the problems that NIR would identify that it feels that it needed George S. May's consulting services to help run more efficiently.
That's totally meaningless. I have no idea what that means as a contract provision.
Sure, Your Honor. I
will assist us with projects to achieve objectives and implement, not even implement processes, something with processes,
yeah.
Identify critical processes, yeah. And establish mechanisms. This is gobbledygook.
Yeah, there are two provisions.
Actually, I'm sure it's already been used as an example in a handbook of gobbledygook. I recall reading things like this.
There are two specific provisions.
How could a contract possibly be breached if we don't know what it means?
Yeah, and that's what the district court was grappling with, is what the specific contractual obligations were for George S. May, and found that not only had NIR not failed to identify those obligations, but it also failed to identify any record evidence that showed that we violated any obligations under that agreement. But there are two specific provisions in the agreement, and one is in paragraph 1, where the paragraphs, and I'm quoting a portion of it, paragraph states that George S. May will, by discussions, recommendations, and progress reports, keep the client informed as to its progress. And paragraph 2 states that George S. May will design an action program around each major objective sought. And maybe what I can do to clarify what that means is to explain a little bit about the process and how it works. With George S. May, what they do when they provide consulting services generally, and this is what happened in this case as well. But generally what happens, Your Honor, excuse me, let's say.
I'm not sure that even matters, counsel, so you might want to move on to something else, because the one concrete provision in this agreement is that NIR will not hire George S. May's employees. And we know what that means because it's pretty unequivocal.
Yes, that is in there.
And it seems to me the whole case turns on that.
Yes. In fact, that is a provision preventing them from hiring our employees for a period of time after we finish the project. And as Your Honors are aware, that was violated when NIR and Mr. Price specifically hired Doan, who was the representative of George S. May at that time. He was a staff executive.
Was that after the contract was completed?
It was right at the time it was finishing up. It was actually around June 2nd, and it was one of the final programs that George S. May was installing or assisting and advising NIR with, and that was the hiring of an employee, a controller. And what happened, and it sounds almost ridiculous, is NIR tries to convince the court that during this process interviewing, there is evidence, and it's pretty clear that Mr. Doan interviewed at least three prospective employees, and he did it on certain dates that are identified in the project reports. But at some point, Mr. Doan came to Mr. Price and had a discussion about hiring him as one of the employees. And Mr. Price admits in his deposition that he knew he wasn't allowed to hire Doan as a controller because of the provision in the contract. But Mr. Price said that Doan gave him some letter, which he claimed was on George S. May letterhead. The letter was never produced in discovery. It was never given to this date. Nobody knows where it's at. But that Mr. Doan produced this and gave it to Mr. Price.
Where is Mr. Doan at the moment?
Mr. Doan is in, I believe, in Missouri at the moment.
In prison?
In custody?
No. He presented this to Mr. Price, and Mr. Price then sat in the office while Mr. Doan picked up the telephone and said he was calling George S. May. And on a one-sided telephone call, he claimed, while Mr. Price sat there, he said basically, yeah, this is William Doan. Is it okay for me to work? And that's not going to be a violation if I work for NIR. Okay, and hangs up the phone. And that was good enough for Mr. Price, according to him. Mr. Price never did anything to follow up with that. He never contacted George S. May to ask him if it was to verify that, to see if that was appropriate. He just went ahead and hired Mr. Doan to work for him. And it wasn't until after Mr. Doan was working for NIR that these alleged checks were written, and they've only identified two checks were written. Prior to that, there is no evidence in the record whatsoever that Mr. Doan did anything improper while working for George S. May. Not only does the project director assigned to the project testify to that in his deposition, he saw nothing that was performed improperly, but NIR's own expert testified at his deposition that he saw nothing that was suspicious or improper until this July 23rd check was written, and that was after he had left us and started working for...
When did May discover that NIR had hired him?
It was in July we discovered it. Mr. Doan did not do any more work for us after this project ended, and usually they'd get assigned out to another project when another one came in. He was not assigned to another project. And
Are they employees or independent contractors?
They're employees, and they were notified. They made the termination was effective June 10th. 1999, and I just want to point out one thing. Regrettably, in our brief, the dates for when he was terminated and when he started working, I believe, were incorrectly put as 2009. It's supposed to be 1999, but the record evidence clearly indicates that. But he said when we found out he was terminated, and that was effective June 10th. So. Even as the latest date that NAR would have you believe that he was no longer working for us, which was July 21st, he still hadn't done any of the alleged embezzlement actions. That didn't come till days later. Also, with respect to the issue of that counsel keeps bringing up that he was a convicted felon and that we had a responsibility to find that out, there's no precedent in Kansas that that there is a duty to run a conflicts check in a situation like this background check on an employee like this. Even had we run it at that time, Mr. Doan had actually he was found guilty of theft, and he was given a suspended imposition of sentence, which under the Missouri criminal code means once he completes a certain probation period, which for him was 2 years, the record would not reflect any conviction whatsoever. So we would not even have found out had we run one if there was such a duty, which there was not. Also, Your Honors, with respect, I want to bring up a couple more points in the time I have left. With respect to the bonding issue, NIR claims that we did not bond Mr. Doan when he performed the services. One, there's no causal connection that even had he not been bonded that there was any damage that resulted of that. But even putting that aside, the issue, the evidence is clear that Doan was covered under a crime policy that George S. May had in place, and it was a crime policy for $500,000, just as George S. May would represent to its customers, and it covered all employees. And there was no requirement whatsoever that Mr. Doan had to complete any kind of application, fidelity bond application or otherwise, in order to be covered under that. The crime policy covered all George S. May's employees, and it states that in the actual document, which is part of the record. The fidelity bond application that NIR relies upon, the one that Mr. Doan states that he was not convicted of a felony, and they state that was not completed. Again, there's no connection between that fidelity bond and the actual policy that was in effect for George S. May. There's no requirement that that application be used or any other application by an employee. And in fact, NIR has provided no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Doan was not bonded. With respect, Your Honors, to the breach of fiduciary duty claim that the counsel has brought forth, the court correctly found that there is no fiduciary relationship or a confidential relationship for the constructive fraud claim that existed between May and NIR. Of the two types of fiduciary relationships that the Kansas courts recognize, they recognize those fiduciary relationships that are specifically created by contract and those that are implied in law, neither of which exist here. There's no provision in the agreement which would create a fiduciary relationship between these two parties, as well as in the implied setting, implied fiduciary duty, Kansas law has a specific requirement that the fiduciary duty must be consciously assumed by the party who's being charged with having violated a fiduciary responsibility. And there is no evidence in the record whatsoever that that George S. May consciously assumed any fiduciary obligation. And that travels right into the constructive fraud claim with
Thank
no
you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I remind you that we expect to receive jurisdictional briefs from both parties within 14 days. The case is taken under advisement. Our fourth case for argument.